From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Work and Life on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Here is Professor Stu Friedman.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Work and Life on SiriusXM's Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm your host, Stu Friedman, and I am an organizational psychologist, which means that I study people at work, but also people outside of work and the relationship between work and all of life. I started the Work-Life Integration Project here over 20 years ago. And on this show, what we do is bring you the greatest minds and people from everyday life, all walks of life, to talk about what we can do to help you to become better able to integrate the different parts of your life in ways that work for all the different parts. Coming up on today's show, I'm really excited to be joined by Katie Milkman, who is a professor here at Wharton and also at the Perelman School of Medicine here at Penn. Katie uses big data to examine choices that we make about self-control, well, and how self-control affects our ability, as I would put it, to lead the lives we truly want to live. So we'll be talking with her shortly. Later on the show, I'll be joined by Lonnie Golden, who's a professor of economics at Penn State, whose research has focused on time and control of time at work. So that's the theme for tonight. We're going to be talking about control. So if you're feeling a little out of control, as so many people that I know are, tonight's show promises to bring you some real insight into what you can do. We are live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern and love to hear from you. So give us an email if you want to write. If you're shy about calling the show, you can write to us at businessradio@siriusxm.com. And you can follow on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at Stu Friedman, which is Stewfriedman. And our channel's Twitter handle is bizradio111. Well, let's get right to it. Katie is here in the studio. We're in Huntsman Hall here in West Philadelphia. And I am thrilled to be welcoming Katie Milkman, who is the James G. Campbell Junior Assistant Professor here at the Wharton School. And she also has a secondary appointment, as I said, at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Katie has been recognized as one of the top 40 business school professors under 40 by Poets and Quants, a very reputable source of evaluation of young professors in America and abroad. And she was also voted, this is seriously impressive, she was Wharton's Iron Prof, and that's a competition that she won against all other Wharton professors here as voted by our MBA students. So I'm really excited to be having a conversation with Katie about her fascinating research on self-control and suboptimal choices and what we can do to, well, make better choices. Katie, welcome to Work and Life.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question for Professor Katie Milkman about what you can do to gain greater control at work and in other parts of your life, give us a call. The number is 844-WHARTON. How about that? 844-942-7866. All right, Katie, so let's start out with just some basic definitions. Self-control, why is this important as something that we need to understand in terms of performance and effectiveness at work?
It's a great question. So self-control is important in actually all aspects of our lives, not just at work, but it has been linked with, for instance, higher IQ outcomes if you have more self-control. And in general, it can be a key to productivity. Think about what you need to do to be successful in the workplace. You have to hit deadlines. You have to stay focused. You have to avoid the distractions of Facebook and YouTube and Twitter. And that requires self-control.
Right. Can I just check my Twitter account for a second? Oh, sorry.
So being able to focus on tasks is a big part of what self-control is.
I see.
But it's also important actually to health. And health also spills over into our performance at work. So if we're in better shape, we're feeling better, we take good care of ourselves in terms of our diet and our exercise routines, visit the doctors, we're going to have less absenteeism at work, and we're going to be more present when we're at work.
So tell me more about the link to higher IQ. I thought that was something that, you develop as a result of knowledge you're exposed to. How is self-control related to higher IQ?
It's a great question. So there's this classic study that was done by Walter Michel, who actually has a new book out very recently, on the marshmallow test. And he has small children come into a laboratory setting. He puts a marshmallow in front of them and says, you can eat this now if you'd like, but if you wait just a little while, we'll bring you a second marshmallow. And then looks to see how long these kids wait. How much self-control do they have?
To delay gratification.
To delay gratification. Can they get that huge return, double, you know, double their the size of the pie or double their number of marshmallows? Mm-hmm. And the longer those kids can wait for the second marshmallow, the higher their IQ turns out to be later in life. They get higher SAT scores, show all sorts of benefits in adolescence and later.
So is the inference there that that's a learned behavior or something that one is born with?
It's a great question and something that people are really still struggling to answer. And
what's your take?
I think it's some of both. That would be my guess. There's certainly research suggesting it's something like a muscle and that you can exercise it and improve its self-control over time. But I don't know to what extent that will improve your IQ subsequently. I imagine it may improve outcomes at work. It certainly improves outcomes in terms of health, which is where a lot of my research focuses.
Well, let's talk about how you got into this. It's such an important topic and something that so many people want to learn more about. Can you just say briefly what turned you to this research area?
So it's me-search, meaning...
Me-search.
I study...
I like that.
...what I struggle with.
Me too. Seriously.
Yeah, no, I think that you have to be passionate about whatever you study. And so, you know, the more self-absorbed your research can be, the more passionate you're going to be about it, in a sense.
No doubt. All right. So this is me-search, Katie Milkman. What does that mean? How did you... What
drove me to it?
What drove you?
So I've always sort of struggled with, you know, cravings for delicious foods and getting myself to the gym at the end of a long day and following through on all the things I know I should do in the long term, but maybe weren't instantly gratifying.
Like, and what else, if I may ask?
Like focusing at work and not checking Facebook and Twitter, for instance. And, you know, I have a major sweet tooth, so staying away from those goodies is difficult. So in general, I struggle with self-control, and that's one of the reasons I got really interested when I started realizing, oh, it's not just me. This is actually a broad phenomenon, and there's people starting to understand solutions, and I can contribute to this literature. And so that's sort of where it came from.
Well, so what have you learned? And I know that's a big question, but
yeah.
Let's start at the high level. Like, what are the big insights that you've gained from your research on a number of different kinds of self-control failures, as you call them? Like, what are those, and what have you learned about how to avoid them?
Well, let me start by telling you a couple stories.
Okay.
So, and I'll try to stay sort of high level, but one of the big things I learned is that uncertainty, incidental uncertainty in your life, is a big bummer for self-control.
So define that, though.
Yeah, I'll be more precise. So you don't know something, and it's hanging over you. You don't know the results of a medical test, maybe, or you don't know where you're going to have a job next year. You're not sure if your investment's going to pay off. You don't know how you're going to spend your time tomorrow at work because it hasn't been determined yet. Even small amounts of uncertainty like that can be harmful. And when I was actually looking for a faculty job is when this idea popped into my mind. And so that's when I started doing some research to causally demonstrate that these kinds of incidental uncertainties hanging over us can actually lead us to reach for the Ben and Jerry's more frequently, not to exert the self-control required to sort of read educational materials instead of, lowbrow magazines, et cetera. So there are a lot, it can lead us to not stay focused and work on problems. So uncertainty is one big bad.
You said incidental uncertainty. What does that mean?
Yeah, great question. So you could imagine uncertainty that is actually relevant to the decision you're making. Like, I'm not sure about something related to my diet, and so that's going to lead me to reach for the ice cream. But that might make total sense, right? If you're not sort of sure you're going to have food next week, you should eat more calories. What we're showing is something sort of much more irrational than that, in a sense. It's uncertainty that's outside of the choice context that's just hanging over you. And so it shouldn't, according to traditional economics, really affect decisions, but we're human, and so it does affect us. It causes us to be distracted, and we're sort of focused on worrying about whatever that is in the background, and we don't have the resources left over to exert the self-control we need to do good things in the rest of our life.
So the anxiety or worry about something that is important to you, but
exactly.
and you don't know how
and
it's going to turn out, that sort of interferes with your capacity to stay focused on the things that you know you should.
That's right. So that's sort of one big picture idea. I think it's very intuitive, and we've demonstrated it as a major problem. Another big picture idea that I think is exciting and that I've been working on recently is sort of good news instead of bad news. And that is, when are the moments when we are most motivated to exert self-control? So this actually came up as a question when I was out visiting Google, the head of HR. I was telling him about a bunch of interventions I've studied. Maybe we'll get to some of them later, that you can use to try to encourage workers to do healthy things and things that they know they should do at a higher rate, like going to the gym and getting flu shots. And the head of HR at Google said to me, okay, you know, that's great, but when do we deploy these interventions? Is there like a magic time when people will be most responsive to them? And I thought, what a great question. We really don't know the answer. And so some of my research has tried to answer that. The first thing that might come to mind when I pose that question could be New Year's. That's what popped into my mind immediately. We know the New Year's effect, right, is out there. So
the New Year's effect being?
People generate resolutions at the beginning of a new year. They set goals and they redouble their efforts to achieve those goals. So people start diets at a higher rate in January than in other months. They go to the gym more and they presumably do lots of other good behaviors more as well. And so what we wanted to see is there something systematic about that? And what we hypothesized was that it's not just New Year's. There are actually many fresh start moments in our lives where we feel like, okay, this is the beginning of a new period.
The beginning of the day.
The beginning of the day is
Seriously,
one kind of...
I feel most optimistic when I'm first waking up.
Absolutely. So you can think about it within the course of a given day. And actually, there's some research on that too. And I've shown that, for instance, people sanitize their hands dramatically more in hospitals earlier in work shifts. And then they sort of get fatigued. The more intense their workday, the more their hand sanitizing declines always really precipitously as the day wears on. But it speeds up the more intense the work. So within the course of a given day, yes, we have fresh starts. But actually, even within the course of a calendar year, we have them. So not just New Year's, but even the start of a new week or a new month or following a birthday, following holidays. These are all moments that sort of segregate the continuous flow of time into more discrete intervals and make us feel like, okay, it's a clean start. It's a new me. I have a clean slate. My past failures are behind me. Okay, yeah, so I failed to quit smoking last month or last year, but I can do it now because this is a new month or a new year, a new week. And we see that people exercise more at the beginning of these fresh start periods, at the beginning of a new week, month, year, the start of a new semester, following holidays, following birthdays, with the notable exception of 21st birthdays. Surprising. Maybe not.
Let me hypothesize why that might result in some out of control behavior.
Yes.
My daughter is approaching her 21st birthday in 2 months. Let me think about that. Never mind. I think I understand.
So that one sort of makes sense. We see that they search more for the term diet on Google at the beginning of those fresh start moments, and they create goals on a goal setting website, stick.com, both health related and health related.
Stick with two K's, right?
Stick KK, yes. There's two K's.
Stick K.
Yes.
It's like Louis C.K., stickk.com.
Yes. Yeah, it's a great website.
Let me just jump in here and remind people we are talking with Katie Milkman, who is a researcher here at Wharton who does research on self-control and how to avoid self-control failures. If this is something that you'd like to ask about, if you have a question or concern about gaining greater self-control in your work and in the other parts of your life, give us a call. We still have some time for a few callers. 844-942-7866 is the number. All right. So, you know what? I'm thinking that many of the world's religions build in to the, you know, to the cycles of time, moments to stop and to both look back and look forward in what are fresh start periods, right? So this wisdom has been around for a while. I expect you've already thought about this. What is any of your research informed by the, you know, the patterns of religious ritual and how those create a kind of, as one religious scholar called, architecture of time?
Absolutely. I think it's a really fascinating topic, and it is indeed one of the things that motivated us, this idea that, you know, in some religions you can be born again, or there are purification rituals, or there are even sort of yearly times when you're supposed to reflect or you're supposed to confess to your sins. And of course, Yom Kippur is right around the corner. We're actually doing some research to see whether or not fresh starts occur at a higher rate in the Jewish population relative to non-Jewish populations right after Yom Kippur. So are there more spikes?
And Yom Kippur, for our listeners who don't know what that is, explain.
Yes, Yom Kippur is a moment on the Jewish calendar when you're meant to sort of repent for your sins and they're wiped clean and you're sort of given a clean slate. And so that's actually coming up in a few days. Yeah, this weekend. And so we've been doing some research around whether or not that moment does create a clean slate and increase self-control in the population that observes.
Hmm. And you expect...
We expect to see that it does. It's too early to know since the holiday hasn't actually arisen yet.
And so what else happened at Google as you advise them in terms of the timing of these interventions?
Yeah. So our advice based on the research we've done so far is that these moments when people have this feeling of a clean slate, mm-hmm. may be moments when it's particularly valuable to offer them reminders or encourage good behavior. So we have ongoing research looking into that. This is all sort of early stage, but so far we have seen these patterns just arising naturally. And the question is, to what extent can you harness them and use them as moments to change behavior?
So there'd be extra messaging, perhaps extra incentives even, built in at these moments when people are more ripe for creating
change.
A fresh start.
Exactly. That's exactly the idea. And if you think about it, if you have a program that you realize you can't sort of roll it out and advertise it every single day with the same intensity to try to help people, you know, get a personal trainer or change their diet habits and meet with a dietitian or, schedule other kinds of interventions with people who may be able to help them improve their behaviors, then when would you roll those out? And our research suggests these fresh start moments might be when people are most open and interested in doing things they aspire to do and getting that help.
So we've got a caller from Minnesota. If you're interested in joining the conversation here, the number again is 844-942-7866. So Molly's calling. Welcome to Work and Life, Molly. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on willpower being exhaustive, like you only have so much and then you run out and that's why you give up on a diet or whatever. And what do you do when that happens?
Oh, I love that question. So there's great research suggesting that this may indeed be the case, that willpower sort of resembles a muscle, and that just like a muscle, it can be exhausted through repeated use, but also like a muscle, it can be strengthened over time. I have one technique that completely fits this category of me-search that sort of tries to harness that concept. And here's the idea. I call it temptation bundling. And I think the idea, it's very simple. Imagine someone, we'll call them Katie, who struggles at the end of a long day to get to the gym, lacks the motivation, and who also finds himself wasting a lot of time watching sort of lowbrow TV shows that are thrillers. What if that person only allowed themselves to watch lowbrow TV shows while exercising at the gym? She'd stop wasting time at home on all this junk TV and start craving trips to the gym to find out what happens at the end of the next show. And not only that, she'll actually enjoy her workout and her show more combined. She won't feel guilty watching the show and time will fly at the gym. So this sort of relates to the idea that we have limited ability to exert self-control because it turns that on its head. It says, okay, it's hard to exert self-control. We can only do so much of it. So let's actually give in to a temptation and use that and harness that power to get ourselves to do the kinds of things we should do. And it's not just about exercise. You can imagine using this temptation bundling technique in other settings as well. So for instance, imagine only letting yourself to go to the burger joint you crave when spending time with a difficult mentee at work, or only letting yourself, for the lady listeners, get a pedicure when catching up on overdue emails.
Men get pedicures too, Katie. just hang on.
Slightly lower rate. or only letting yourself, for instance, listen to your favorite radio show or watch your favorite TV show while catching up on household chores. So those are all examples of how temptation bundling can kind of harness.
And how does that help in response to Molly's wonderful question to strengthen willpower as opposed to have it be something that exhausts you?
Right. So because you actually are giving in to one temptation when you're engaging in temptation bundling, you could imagine that it hopefully is not nearly as depleting and exhausting to go to the gym, because while you're doing it, you're getting this indulgence at the same time. So you're distracted. It doesn't feel like such an exertion of willpower, and you're letting yourself give in to an indulgence, which some research has even shown can increase available willpower stores for future self-control decisions.
Available willpower storage. So it's something that you like, you harvest and hold on
that's
to.
That's the theory that's out there. Yeah. So this isn't really my work. This is really the work of brilliant psychologist Roy Baumeister. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of building on his theories here, but he's done a lot of excellent work with many collaborators showing that, again, yeah, you can store these resources, you can save them up, you can spend them and exhaust them, and you need breaks in order to restore willpower, and you need to give in to these temptations from time to time in order to have more stores of willpower.
Molly, thanks so much for that call. Really instructive for all of us. If you have a call for Katie Milkman about it, what you can do to gain more control and make some more intelligent choices, better choices at your workplace or any part of your life, the number again is 844-942-7866. So where have you seen the greatest impact in your research in terms of learning how to avoid or building systems that help you to avoid self-control failures?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard question. The biggest impact. Well, one idea that's so simple it's almost painful has had a lot of impact, in part because it's free, and so lots of people are now using it. And this idea is just prompting people to form concrete plans about exactly when they're going to follow through on behaviors that require self-control. So let me be more concrete.
Okay.
We ran this experiment with a large Midwestern utility company, and they were holding on-site free flu shot clinics at work.
Which is something that's good for them, good for their people. It's going to reduce healthcare costs.
And absenteeism, hopefully, et cetera. And, you know, have healthier workers who are, mm-hmm. again, more present in the workplace when
mm-hmm.
they're there.
Mm-hmm.
So they hold these clinics. And normally what they do is they just send out a reminder mailing to everyone. And they say, you know, here are the dates and times and locations where we'll hold these flu shot clinics. And we said, you know, we have an idea for making that more powerful. Let's send the same mailing you've always sent, but let's just add one little component. Let's prompt people to write down the date and time when they intend to come. Now, it's not an appointment card. They're not mailing this back to anyone.
It's just putting it on their calendar?
We're just asking them. Literally, there's like a fill-in-the-blank box on this reminder mailing where we just prompt them. Write it down here for yourself. Think through the date and time when you intend to come in. Everything else about the mailing is identical. So we then run this big experiment. We randomly assign some people to get the standard mailing.
Right.
And some people to get this new mailing that has one addition. Write it down.
So that's the variable.
So incredibly simple. Has a big effect. Costless to change. We see the average rate at which people are showing up for these flu shot clinics goes up by about 13%. And we more than double the effect of this intervention when we look at work sites with only one day flu shot clinics, as opposed to, you know, you can come any day this week,
uh-huh.
where we'd think forgetfulness and procrastination would be most costly. And so what we
think, the one day clinics.
That's right. The
right.
one day clinics, because
mm-hmm.
if you forget or you put
that's
it off.
It.
Yeah, it's all over.
No makeup.
Yeah, so in those sites, we see turnout for flu shots going from 30% to 38% in these two groups. Again, it costs nothing.
And what kind
of
financial impact does that have on a company? Any guesstimates?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, it depends on exactly what. So I don't have a great guesstimate on flu shots. It could have a big impact depending on the behavior you're using it mm-hmm. to change. Mm-hmm. So we were focused on flu shots. And one of the ways that I think this has been impactful is this work has been disseminated pretty widely and is increasingly being used for other things, too. For instance, we ran a similar study to try to get people to go get colonoscopies. And we saw that that was also effective, just prompting people to think about when will you get a colonoscopy and with whom. Write that down for yourself, prompting them to make that concrete plan, increase turnout. And so there we can actually sort of think about how many mm-hmm. lives we can save. And it's a very non-negligible number when you scale this to the whole U.S.
It seems so simple. I mean, this is something that is new that we don't know. I mean, it just seems like shockingly
it's so
easy
simple.
To...
It's so simple. It's not...
The very largest network of female professionals or... this amazing enterprise solution that you can just sell to every company today.
I unfortunately need to move on to the next caller. I know we could talk about this forever. And Eileen, thank you so much. I really appreciate you calling into the show. We obviously wish you so much luck with your business. You're tackling a really important and critical issue, especially right now for women in business. So thank you so much for calling in with that.
And for our listeners that are women, sign up at glassbreakers.co.
Put anything on it. And we're seeing these big effects. Again, it costs absolutely nothing more than sending a regular mailing to add this. And so that's where we've seen some
so
big impact.
If you're running a business and you're trying to get people to comply with something that might
they might forget that, about, they might put off.
That they may not want to do because it's a little bit uncomfortable for them to do it, or it's just painful for them to do it, or it requires them to focus on something. It's not their first priority.
This can be a really helpful way to get over that hump. I'd say it has to be something they have some intention to do, right? So if I send this to you and I say, go stand on your head. Or make a plan about when you're going to go stand on your head. Well, you have no interest in standing on your head. There's
no benefit. Actually, that's part of a yoga routine that I would like to learn. So,
well, if you can frame it that way, then it might work. But again, if you're just telling them to do some irrelevant behavior that's a waste of their time, mm-hmm. or that's how they perceive it, it's mm-hmm. not going to work. But
it's got to be in their interest, right?
That's right. Something they mean to do, but they might forget or put off, and not be like super jazzed about making sure it happens in the moment. This is a way to overcome forgetfulness and procrastination.
Do you apply this in your own research, Katie?
Absolutely. All of these tactics are now driving my husband crazy, and they're things.
Wait,
that...
is it life better for him as a result if you're doing the things that are important to you/him?
Maybe, except I'm not sure he loves it when I nag him to make a concrete plan about exactly where and when he'll follow through on various commitments.
Oh, I see. You're trying to impose this regimen on his behavior. I thought
and my own. Yeah, it's broader than that, but yeah, no, it's I definitely use it for myself, and I temptation bundle.
Meaning?
So I listen to lowbrow novels while I exercise and only while I exercise, and they lure me back to the gym. My favorite is The Hunger Games. That's the best for this particular technique.
Okay. Wharton professor, listening to The Hunger Games while working out. That works. All right. Lisa, our producer, is shaking her head saying, I'm going to do that. Hunger Games, Lisa? You're down with that? Okay. Well, so what stops you, though, from listening to The Hunger Games when you're just lounging around in the evening? Maybe you've had a glass of wine, your willpower is a little reduced, and your husband says, hey, I haven't seen The Hunger Games in a while. What do you say, Katie?
It's a great question. So actually, an experiment we ran tested different ways of trying this temptation bundling technique. So we had a control group that didn't get access to tempting audio novels at all, and they got a gift certificate to Barnes & Noble. We had a full treatment group that gets to listen to the beginning of a tempting audio novel and is told if they want to hear what happens next, they'll have to come back to the gym because we'll be holding it for them in a locked, monitored locker. And then we have...
So the only way they could access it.
Only can listen to The Hunger Games or whatever tempting novel they've picked is at the gym, compared to the control group that just gets a Barnes & Noble gift certificate, nothing tempting waiting for them at the gym, just a prompt to exercise more. And then we have this intermediate group, actually, that also listens to the beginning of a tempting novel and is told, try to only let yourself listen at the gym, but there's no actual restriction.
Try.
So just,
that's pretty loose.
It's just a prompt. It's a suggestion. Maybe if you can link these two things for yourself, this will work. And actually, we see some benefits just in that intermediate group. So it's better if someone else ties your hands and make sure you can only access it at the gym. That's sort of the first best, is getting someone else to handle your self-control problem. But we can actually impose these kinds of rules on ourselves. And it's, I think, related to what we know about how people can set goals and stick to those goals. So this seems to be something that's not impossible for people to self-impose.
But it's better if you've got somebody else.
If you have someone else to help you, then you don't have to exert any self-control or willpower to bundle these two things, and then you're probably best off.
All right. Well, so this leads me to my last question for you, Katie, and that is, what advice do you have for our listeners who are struggling with self-control and have had self-control failures? What's the most important thing that you can impart to them as to what they can do now?
Tomorrow is the first day of a new month. It's a fresh start.
It is. It's October 1st tomorrow, if you're listening live.
Harness that fresh start, start temptation bundling, and make concrete plans about all your goals.
So temptation bundling, put
something you enjoy and look forward to and crave together with something you know you should do. Only let yourself enjoy that craving or indulgence when you're doing the thing you should. And make concrete plans about when and where you'll follow through on good behaviors.
Concrete plans. Put it down in your calendar. You know, where, when, and with whom, that's going to increase the chances of you're actually doing it, which is probably going to get you closer to leading the life you really want to live.
That's the hope.
That is the hope.
It's working for me.
It's working for Katie, and Katie is living the dream. So I think you want to do what Katie's doing. Katie Milkman, thank you so much for joining me this hour here on Work and Life. It's been delightful talking with you and highly instructive. If you want to learn more about Katie Milkman, you can follow her on Twitter at get this now, K-A-T-Y, Katie, underscore Milkman, M-I-L-K-M-A-N. Katie, thanks again so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Stay with us. We will be right back with Penn State Professor of Economics, Lonnie Golden, who's going to join me to tackle another aspect of the control issue, and that is the control of time at work. I'm Stu Friedman, and you're listening to Work and Life on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM 111.
You're listening to Work and Life on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Here again is Professor Stu Friedman.
Welcome back to Work and Life on Sirius XM's Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I am Stu Friedman. I'm director of Wharton's Work-Life Integration Project. If you're just joining us, what we do on this show is bring you experts, CEOs, workers of all kinds, students. The goal here is to bring you useful information, information that's going to help you to create a greater sense of harmony among the different parts of your life so that you can be better equipped to lead the life you truly want to live. We are live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern and love to hear from you. So I'll give you the call-in number shortly, but if you want to write to me, if you prefer to write, here's the address, businessradio@siriusxm.com. You can also follow on Twitter at Stu Friedman, which is S-T-E-W-F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N, Stu Friedman. And you can follow our channel at Biz Radio 111. That's B-I-Z Radio 111. Joining me here in West Philadelphia on the University of Pennsylvania campus, beautiful day here in West Philly, is Lonnie Golden. Lonnie is a professor of economics and labor employment relations at Penn State University Abington College. His research really centers on the issue of time and hours at work. He's one of the leading experts on this topic in the world, and the impact of work on well-being, happiness, and all kinds of economic outcomes. Lonnie, welcome to Work and Life.
Thank you, Stu. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. And if you have a question for Lonnie, Professor Golden, about what your company can do or what you can do about managing time better at work, and especially improving flex time practices, give us a call at 844-WHARTON. That's 844-942-7866. So Lonnie, last week we had Carol Evans here from Working Mother, and Working Mother just put out their best places to work list. One of the things, of course, that they focus on when rating the great companies is their work flex programs. Your research, if I have it right, suggests that it's not just about flex, but, well, how flex happens, who has control over time. So these programs that seem to be so important in rating the great companies, do they really work?
What we know is they work for the employees, and they also work for the employer, for the organizations, particularly in the longer run. We do know that people's ability to control the timing of their work does have, not surprisingly, positive effects on their well-being. So some of those get transmitted over to the organization as well if they face fewer time conflicts at the beginning or at the end of the workday. But we also find that having some control to time one's work and time one's non-work activities across the day matters even more than at the beginning of the day.
So like when you start your work cycle.
That really matters when you start your work cycle and when you end it, but maybe taking time off during the day is also very powerful. So that might reflect, as you're suggesting, a wider condition about control over one's work time, not just the flex time at the beginning and end of the day, which is, itself is important, but also control over timing, you know, from day to day or within the workday as well.
Control over timing as to when you take breaks and when you're on? Is that what you're referring to?
I believe that's part of it. And the surveys that we've analyzed, they don't break it quite down to that fine detail. Mm-hmm. It's nice to have if we can examine that. But I think when you take breaks, when you go do something for personal or family reasons during the day, an extended period of time, seems to have really positive effects on people's well-being, how they feel about life generally, and we presume, therefore, how productive they'll be at work and how happy they'll be with that particular job. So it's not surprising that the leading companies that offer flex time working or more control over work time generally would be something that employees, particularly the millennials, are seeking in an employer these days.
Particularly millennials, because
they rank the flexibility very highly in terms of types of compensation or benefits or conditions of work that they prefer for their employment.
And there again, it's not just a matter of the policy on paper, but the reality of having discretion, having control as to when one is on, when one is not on.
I believe that's right. I think there's a couple different dimensions that there's the formal practice or policy, we have flex time, but then there's the informal organizational support, supervisor support, coworker support, which also plays into that as well. So if the supervisor is very firm about your FaceTime presence, even if there is a flex time policy, then you're not going to get some of the benefits of that to the employee or to the employer.
Mm-hmm. That's really a critical variable, isn't it? You've got to have a boss who gets it.
Yes.
But many don't get it, or they're threatened or see that it's a loss of control.
Yes.
If I give you as somebody working for me control over when you're working, when you're not, how can I trust you?
Right.
To get the work done and to be available when I need you to. I'm sure that's something that you've thought a lot about. What's been your observations about how you kind of break through that barrier to change?
Well, I think that you're going to have some people that might abuse it or take advantage of it, sure. But mm-hmm. in most cases, it is on the part of the manager to, like you say, to give up some of that control. And then he or she will find that the great majority of people not only appreciate it and are just as productive, but they might return the favor in terms of a reciprocal performance and retention and loyalty and cooperation that you're trying to get out of the employees. So but it is very hard for some people to let go of the FaceTime, I need you here then, I need you here exactly mm-hmm. then. And that I think has led, especially in the post-recession times, a lot of employers have been curbing this, worried that particularly the work at home issue, mm-hmm. Worried that they can't trust employees.
So is that the trend?
Well, I think it's part of, I don't know if it's a trend, but I would say that's part of the cycle. Mm. So that if the job market is picking up, I think enough employees will demand this, want this, stay at organizations that offer this, where the tide will turn a little bit toward.
Toward what?
Sorry. Well, toward offering more of it again. But right now, I think, as you suggest, there are some climates where organizations are not, and particularly supervisors might not be trustful or worried that their employees aren't trustworthy.
I have an idea about that. Sure. Let me just remind people, we are talking about flex time and control over time at work and how important that is, how important it is to millennials, but to all employees to be able to control their time gives them a much greater sense of well-being and a greater commitment to you and to your organization. I'm speaking with Professor Lonnie Golden, who's done a lot of research on this area, one of the world's experts. If you're interested in joining the conversation, or if you have a question about what you can do to improve your own company's use of time, particularly flex time practices, give us a call, 844-942-7866. So what I've seen is that time-bound experiments. Let's just try this for a few weeks and see how it works. And if it works for you and it works for me, well, then maybe we'll continue. And if not, we'll go back to, you know, the way things were. Or we'll try something different. What do you think? Mm-hmm. And that approach of bounding in time, an experiment where both parties are interested in seeing the results mm-hmm. that work for both parties so that it's a win-win, that tends to break down resistance to trying something new. What's your take?
Well, I would certainly favor that. If the obstacle is that they don't trust employees, then yeah, you run it as a temporary experiment, mm-hmm. and then see how people respond. I think what tends to happen is that process of reciprocity begins to become engaged. So someone who feels like they're receiving a benefit like that, mm-hmm. and we underestimate this control over time as something valuable.
Underestimate it.
I think a lot of people
do. We don't know how important it really is.
Until you lose it or until you gain it. Yeah, I think that's safe to say. Mm-hmm. So we really would learn a lot from an experiment like that, because I think if you can get past that first barrier of I don't trust employees or too many people will abuse this, you might find that if the experiment is for a lengthy period of time, that people wind up putting in not only as many, but maybe even longer hours if they have control over the flexibility or start and end times.
So if you let people control their time, they're going to give you more of it?
I believe that
really?
That might be the case.
I hear a lot of skepticism out there of people listening to that statement.
We find in just national data or data sets and big surveys that people that have this flexibility that we're talking about actually put in longer hours.
Wow.
So it's not necessarily true that one leads to the other, but I wouldn't be surprised if people that have control over the time that they start and work or can take off time during the day, in the end, probably put in longer hours. Now, this is mainly about salary employees, right? So where the flexibility okay. tends to be lacking is our hourly workforce. Mm-hmm. They don't have quite maybe half the access to flex time or ability to take time off during the day that the salaried employees do.
Right.
But so that experiment might be even more fruitful if we could find that hourly employees, too, if they have just a little bit of give on starting and ending times, could wind up being available for work longer, and maybe willing to put in, you know, a longer work day.
Has there
extra
been any
days.
Research done on that? On the, I know that most of the work on flex time is about people who are salaried.
Yes.
Do we know anything about how this might play out in an hourly workforce?
We do know that the hourly workforce gets less of it, but it's not a trivial percentage. So when we analyze data that separate the hourly from the salaried people, you can find, let's say, in our research about well-being, that people in the hourly jobs actually appreciate it more, let's put it that way, or it has bigger bang for happiness or for satisfaction.
And perhaps
for
that,
jobs.
That reciprocity motivation, right? Like you're more wanting to give back to somebody who's giving flexibility and control to you if you're an hourly employee?
Yes, especially if you're an hourly employee, we think because you're relatively deprived of it. And that it helps people balance, you know, their daily life navigation for those that really have little control over time generally. So just a little bit of give on the work time can go a long way.
A little bit of give. Can you give an example about like what a little bit of give might look like for an hourly employee if you're a supervisor of one or a group of them?
Hard to know from our national surveys, but it would probably play out on the ground as something like take a longer than usual lunch break. Take a longer than usual break if you got to handle something with your family or personal life, and just stay a little later for that, or don't. And people will make themselves available. So a little bit of give could also be the beginning of a workday. There's maybe a chronic time flicked with getting kids ready for school or childcare. So a little bit of extension of the beginning time in exchange for a little bit later end time probably would go a long way.
Doesn't have to be a lot to get a lot in return.
I'd agree with that.
All right, we've got James calling from Virginia. If you're interested in joining the conversation with Professor Lonnie Golden about work time and how to gain greater control of it or to use it more intelligently, give us a call. It's 844-942-7866. James, welcome to Work and Life.
Hello, how are you?
So tell us, what's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to agree with the professor. For the last 3 years, I worked from home providing program management support to an Air Force program. And during that time, I and my wife would tell you that I worked way more than the 8 hours a day. And the feeling that I had and that I told people and told my bosses is that I felt obligated and required to be more productive because, you know, I didn't...
Did you feel guilty?
Not because I felt guilty, but because I knew that you know, my clients and my leadership didn't have eyes on me. So I had to, you know, I wanted to prove that I was not only doing my work, but that I was being responsible for the company and being proactive and taking an initiative and doing all the things and more that somebody who's sitting in the office would do.
So what was the ultimate result of that? And is there something that you wanted to ask Professor Golden about what you did?
But not so much, you know, something I wanted to add, just you know, agree with his statement. So ultimately, I ended up being promoted. But some of the things that I did was, you know, I always answered my phone. You know, there was, you know, I was never not there to answer a question, whether it was from my company or from the client.
What do you think about that, Lonnie?
Well, I think James's point is really interesting. So it's playing out what we're finding in a national data study, which is that people feel obligated or feel compelled to return a favor if they're granted these kind of working conditions. And I mean, he was obviously striving anyway, but felt like he wanted to prove himself and wound up with a promotion, I think is really, really instructive.
James, thank you so much for your call. We've got Shauna calling from Seattle. Shauna, how can we help you? And welcome to Work and Life.
Hi. I will be having a new business kind of start to go live come January. It's a seasonal service business, very similar to a food truck. One of the things that I'm considering doing is allowing employees to work overtime if the sales justify the overtime by a certain percentage.
Okay.
I also think that this might encourage my employees to not push, but really get out there and try to, you know, engage the consumers and everything else. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
Monty?
Well, Shauna, I presume they're getting paid time and a half, so you're trying to, or some sort of pay if they're extending their work hours?
Yeah, they it will be an hourly pay, and of course, overtime up here in Washington State is time and a half. And from the research that we've done so far, we think that the sales could definitely, if they really pick up and once the idea gets going, very well justify time and a half for minimum wage employees. So it would be good for them and us.
Well, I love that idea of an experiment, and I would be optimistic that that would work for the reasons we were just addressing, which is that when people appreciate, you know, the extension of flexibility, in this case, it also involves additional compensation. And since you just added there the minimum wage, we know a lot of minimum wage employees are hungry for additional work hours for mm-hmm. the time and a half income. So it sounds like a recipe for a win-win.
Shauna, thank you so much for calling Work and Life. Lonnie, let me follow up on this issue of overtime and control. So, more time is clearly in the economic interests of employees. What about greater control? Will people give things up to have greater control of their time?
I think the issue, like you're suggesting, is not longer hours all the time. It's just the opportunity that they can refuse. Or if they have a higher value attached to that extra time, then it might be difficult to turn down if the money's a time and a half. So I also wanted to add that we don't necessarily want the employers, even with positive incentives like that, to encourage people to work forever, you know, all mm-hmm. day, all night long.
Because they'll burn out or perhaps yeah. even die.
Yeah.
There was a story about that in the New York Times earlier today about this woman who was working three shifts and she fell asleep in her car and was right. Died.
Right. There's a whole literature on the various health and safety effects mm-hmm. on long hours, and it pretty much turns after 10 or 11 hours mm-hmm. that it begins to be, the risk begins to really escalate in terms of those effects. And then there are the other ones about the cumulative ones that people on long hours wind up being more at risk of diabetes and cardiac issues. So, yes.
So there are all kinds of health consequences. Lonnie, we are out of time here. So, the time has flown. If you had one 20-second piece of advice for people in organizations struggling with gaining greater control of time and how to use time more effectively, what would it be?
Well, you'll probably find that your own control over time is something that you value not only personally, but is important for your performance over the long run. So why not share that with your employees and subordinates and see what happens? It's probably going to be something that is a long-run investment that will pay off in the future for you.
And it's certainly worth experimenting with if you can figure out a creative way to do that in a way that doesn't cost you very much.
Right, exactly. It's a very low-cost experiment, and if the cost of administering it and supervising it begin to really escalate, you can always pull it back a little bit. But you'll probably find that the employees value this more highly than you anticipated.
Lonnie Golden, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, insights, your research on time at work and how to use it better. It's been wonderful having you here. If our listeners want to learn more about your work, where should they go?
You can just look me up, Lonnie Golden. I have papers up at the Social Science Research Network at Penn State University. And I have a new report coming out as an affiliate of the Economic Policy Institute, which is addressing overtime pay coverage for the low-salaried workforce. And it involves this issue of flexibility. So look that one up and find me in the academic literature.
Thank you so much for being here, Lonnie. All right. Well, this hour we have been talking about control. Katie Milkman with some great tips based on her research as a behavioral economist on how to gain greater self-control at work and in the other parts of your life, and Lonnie Golden's insights, especially about how it doesn't have to cost a lot to give people in your business a little bit of control that helps them to feel better about what they're able to get done. And they're going to give you back a lot in turn. That's kind of the big idea here as I think about Professor Golden's research. It doesn't take a lot to gain a greater sense of commitment to the things that matter and to your collective interests. And so try it. Try giving up some control and seeing what you get in return. All right. Well, thank you so much for tuning into today's show, Work and Life. And thanks to our producer, Lisa Montaneo, and our engineer, Dan Baker. Next week, big show next week, I'm going to be joined by two guests who are also subjects of my new book, which is going to be released next Tuesday. The book is called Leading the Life You Want, Skills for Integrating Work and Life. And on our show next week, two of those people who I profile of the six will be here. One is the former CEO of Bain & Company and co-founder of Bridgespan. That's Tom Tierney. And the other is Julie Foudy, who is a National Soccer Hall of Famer and Olympic gold medal captain, currently an ESPN analyst and a champion of women's advancement in sports. You won't want to miss this show. For information about our roster of other upcoming guests, you can visit worklife.wharton.upenn.edu. And I'd love to hear from you. So follow on Twitter at Stu Friedman, S-T-E-W-F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N. Until next time, thank you for listening to Work and Life on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School on Sirius XM 111.